Our colleagues are still in the in the witch meeting. Some of them will be joining us soon. I learned that they are finished now. We got an apology from the Department of Defense that Mkabatele, unfortunately, is busy somewhere. That formal apology, I think, will be done by the relevant people. But I was phoned by the minister's office to say we shouldn't be surprised if Mr. Dladla is not here, the person who was leading in the deliberations of the bill before us. I think even before the formal apology is tabled, I don't think we'll have a problem in accepting the apology. If there are questions that they might need his special attention, I think they'll be referred to then. Now, before we get into the bill, what I want us to look at, colleagues, is you'll recall that there is this review of the criminal justice system where Parliament would be visiting provinces from the 24th of November to the 5th of December. The arrangement is that we'll split into two groups, that is both houses, but they will be forming, not that the NCOP will go on their own and NA, no. From the NCOP and NA will be one group, but split into two, whereby, you remember when we were doing the DSO briefings to provinces, that will be the kind of arrangement that's going to take place when we go to this visit to provinces. In fact, the purpose thereof, not only to talk to people about this review of the criminal justice system, also to give a report back as to how far have we gone in terms of the DSO bills. Now, that would be a very exciting engagement with our communities. The arrangement now will be slightly different from what we did when we were briefing provinces about the DSO bills. In this instance, what's going to happen is that Team A or Team B, they will spend 2 days in one province. So those will be going to, let's say, Free State, for example. They'll spend 2 days in Free State, spend 2 days in KZN, 2 days in Northern Cape, in that order. And those will be going to the inland stream will do the same. Now, the same format will apply where, in terms of the Western Cape, both teams will come together and confront Western Cape. Why am I saying this, honorable members, colleagues? The multi-party smaller committee will be meeting this afternoon between 1 and 2 in the same venue. We have the meeting, but there was nobody from our opposition parties. So I wanted to check from our opposition parties as to who can avail themselves to part of that meeting. Because from the ruling party as well, it was only myself and Nduli, but the team was limping, so we had to get two more members from the ruling party to be part of that team. And from the opposition in the NCOP, we don't mind having even two parties. Not necessarily to have one, but two. So that when we plan this thing, we plan together. Today's meeting will be to get a briefing as to how far are the arrangements in terms of the venues. Because what we want to do now is to identify venues that are accessible to people. Because what we noticed in the previous engagement, there were DSO bills. Some of the venues were fine, yes, but some of them really. Let me give you an example of the visit in Limpopo. Went to a casino. People had to travel all over to go to that hall at the casino, at Meropa Casino. And that was unfair to people. People had to drive all over, you know. So there was no particular stakeholder that would say, this is our place. We are just, it's walking distance from us to go to the venue. Everybody had to travel to that venue. So the officials will be briefing us today as to how far are they with this kind of arrangements, even to identify stakeholders. And all those other logistics, I can't bore you with those. Now, I will have to, in the meantime, just to get a feel of Doc Van Heerden and Honorable Leroux, because I see you are still here, as to whether who can avail itself to be part of those visits in November and the first 3 days of December. As you are aware, Honorable Leroux, as a caring society, we had to do this. So that's what I wanted to brief your colleagues about, and just to get your feel about it. Just to, I know you won't disappoint me. You have never disappointed me. Now, note that one. The second issue I want to address you on, so that when you comment, you comment on both. We are aware that today we're supposed to debate the second-hand goods bill. But for reasons known to the powers that be, the debate has been deferred. There is a possibility we might debate that bill either on this coming Thursday or even in November. Now, the reason that was given to me, but I was not happy with how the information was conveyed to yours truly. Because what happened, I was just checking with the minister yesterday to say, Minister, are you aware that we're debating this thing? Are you coming to lead a debate? So the minister said, no, I was ready to come, Hoshi, but I just got a message now from my secretary that the debate has been postponed or deferred. That was news to me, and that was at about 1 yesterday. I was in my office. So it was a bit strange, so I had to scratch around and look for my secretary and check all these things. She was also in the same confusion to say she was also got this information. The reason is that there's a problem between the Department of Safety and Security and the Office of the State Law Advisors. The amendments, as amended, as effected by this committee, the department didn't give them to the Office of the State Law Advisor on time. And for the past 8 or 10 days or so, the Office of the State Law Advisor that kept their document with them, it was only released on, when was it? Friday. Yeah, on Thursday. In terms of the rules, yeah, they had to be done prior, so some days before the debate ensued. So that confusion, I raised an alarm on behalf of you colleagues to say it's unacceptable because this committee has done everything that we had to do and we didn't flout any rule. So because of the alarm I raised, the chairperson of the council of the NCOP, Honorable Matlangu, has called the management in the committee section. They are meeting him today at 12 to try and address this issue as to who is fooling who here or who is to blame. Because my committee can't be held at ransom because of some people's mistakes. And people didn't spend some weekends trying to prepare their speeches and stuff. And at this committee, our table is full. We had to remove some of these things if we had to. But to keep this debate unnecessary simply because some people didn't do their work, I mean, it's just unacceptable. So there we are, colleagues. I want to apologize for you, colleagues. I know you are ready for to debate this afternoon, but the debate won't take place. So my apologies to that. But the matter is being addressed by the powers that be. So those are the two issues, colleagues, that I want you to advise me on. The first one about the visit to provinces, and but this, the last one, I think, was just for information. But if you want to comment on it, by all means, feel free to touch on it. I pause. Honourable Van Herden and Honourable Lero.
Chairperson, thank you. Regarding our program, thank you for this indication. At least now we know where we stand with the program. As far as myself is concerned, Chairperson, I've got a meeting at 1 o'clock, a WIP meeting for WIP, so maybe I will ask reluctantly the DA to stand in for me. But in the first place, in the second place, Chairperson, as far as the program is concerned, maybe you are aware that I'm also a trustee of the Political Office Bearers Pension Fund. And we have another trustee meeting on the 26th and the 27th of November. I don't want to miss at all this program arrangements for the review of the justice system. So if you will bear with me, I would like to attend wherever I prefer, of course, the Free State, to go there and then maybe just move away for those 2 days, get here, the meeting will be in Cape Town, I take it, and then revert back. If you will consider that, then I will be I would be glad to be able to take part of this. And then while I am on this topic, Chairperson, as far as I see that we have a program here next week when you take Parliament to the people in the Eastern Cape, I have arranged to take Parliament to the Free State. So I will not on my own, Chairperson, if you will then on the 4th of November. On the 4th of November I will represent Parliament in the Free State. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, my apologies, sir, for being late this morning. Our plane was slightly delayed, and I regret that I couldn't be at the start. As far as the debate this afternoon, I'm actually quite glad, because now it's done. I have a brilliant speech. You can wait for Thursday, you'll see. But so it's done, so I needn't worry any further about that. Then taking Parliament to the people in the Eastern Cape, that will be quite exciting. We're looking forward to that. But then from the 2nd of November, sir, I've been selected to serve on the selection panel for candidates for the Democratic Alliance. And as you know, we plan to do very well in the next election, so I have a very important job to do. So I will discuss this further with you privately and also with my colleagues before I can comment on that, sir. And then lastly, sir, we have an urgent caucus meeting at 12 o'clock. We had some startling news from the Mosia Lakota camp, and so we are meeting at 12, so you must please excuse me at 5 to 12, Mr. Chairman.
I think Honourable Khalid must respond to some of these things. You know, we can't let this go, you know. The DA, can steal our lamb light here, you know. No, we can't accept this. Honourable Khalid.
No, Chair. I'm just surprised. Why is this honourable member getting carried away? But be careful, we are chasing the wind.
Doc, if Mr. LaRue has such important matters in his party to attend to during the 1 o'clock meeting that you envisage with the planning situation for this visit, then maybe I must try to excuse myself from the WIPS meeting and rather attend here, because I think it's important to have a proper planning for this particular meeting. So I understand. I will go and apologize for the WIPS meeting, and then I will be here at this meeting. Thank you.
Yeah, I think you'll do well representing the DA as well. I think. I think it's good that Honourable Leroux is not part of that meeting. Yeah, welcome to our WIPS. I had already conveyed the apology that you will be joining us to say peace in the WIPR or programming meeting. Yeah, it was whispered into my ear that finally tea is ready. Is it ready? Oh my word. Business unusual. Yeah, we will inform in due course our colleagues about the discussion between 1 and 2. There's a planning meeting of the multi-party small group at 1. We'll be duly informed about that. Yeah, having said that, it's true, Honorable Leroux and Honorable Fanyarde, when we'll be in the Eastern Cape on the program taking Parliament to the people, we requested that we be allowed to meet as a committee there. That is both clusters, the security cluster, even local government, will be meeting there. I'm hopeful that they will allow us to meet. I want to plead with you, colleagues, that on Thursday, the National Assembly, through both Potolo committees, Justice and Safety, with the support of all parties, including DA and FF+, they'll be passing the DSO bills this coming Thursday. They will pass the bill that enables us to try and restructure the DSO, you know, restructure, you know, just to put things nicely, just to restructure, and, you know, so that it be effective in terms of fighting crime, you know. So, and I want to, in advance, thank our colleagues here, because they will try to persuade their colleagues to support the bill so that they will fight crime in this country, you know, so that we effectively fight crime. I know they're going to support the bill. Now, the message is that immediately after the bill will be passed by the NA, it will be referred to us, as you are aware, and that will need us to dedicate much of our time to those bills. Because I've been informed by the leadership that we had to meet. They will allow us to meet all the days of the week so that we finalize those bills. So just be ready. Immediately, it is done that side. As you have seen, tentatively in our program, we'll try to slot it in. We'll have to be very, very busy. Very, very busy. Now, that was just to sensitize you to say, be ready, because we are going to meet possibly from Monday to Fridays, you know. But as you know, a chairperson is very flexible. If you are nice to me, we might exclude some other days, depending how you behave towards your chairperson. Those were the housekeeping issues, colleagues. We can now go back to the defense bill. But I see some hands from Honorable Nyanda, Honorable Fanyarde, before we start.
Thank you, Chairperson. Sorry to be late. Chairperson, I don't know. I heard you saying that we'll be meeting in the Eastern Cape, but I think the House Chair is going to talk to you. They are saying they are not going to allow that. We are taking Parliament to the people only.
I think I'm just corrected. It's the constituency week, 27th to 31st of October. And on constituency week, there's a meeting on the Thursday on the negotiating mandates, 14th Amendment Law. They are not going to allow that because we need to be out there for registration.
No, it's fine. We'll yeah. If there's that that message to say we should avoid those days.
Yeah.
Maybe they say that, no, I think we will. In fact, even if they can say we should not meet until next January, we'll be happy to go out there and deal with exactly what Honorable Leroux was saying. Yeah, we'll appreciate that. But unfortunately, this will be there to be passed still. But thanks for sanitizing us. We'll see. We'll get some directives as to how we're going to do it. If they refuse us to meet in the Eastern Cape, I mean, it's fine. But that would mean this committee will be bound. They're going to inconvenience this committee. We might meet when people are gone. So let's just be ready for that. We're trying to avoid that, so that when people are going to their conscience, we'll be there as well. But if we don't have a slot to meet there, we should go to this is all. So if really that's the message we're getting to say, if you don't meet there, it means when people will be gone, we'll have to remain here and pass those bills. Poor Indababa. Yeah, having done that, Honorable Mac.
I just wanted to also say, give you the information, Chair. The Chief Whip has been mandated to the Political Committee meeting 11 o'clock that all 76 bills that are still on their way from the NA must stay there. We are not going to do them. And that she is definitely, Political Committee must sort out what is urgent to be done, that will be done, and separate. So we are definitely looking to bring down the load. Thank you.
Yeah, that's the progressive message I'm getting. Yeah. Doc?
Sorry, but the last issue before we start with the this, you referred to the DSO bills. If you can just give us a rough indication when you envisage that we must sit so that we can avail ourselves. At this stage, I have no idea. And you know, Chairperson, if we make other arrangements, then we will not be able to. I will not be able to attend. So, if I can have just a rough indication, if it is on the program. Maybe it is. I haven't looked at it.
Yeah, I'll truly oblige Dr. Van Heerden, because you are so good to me and this committee. I'll do it for free. Now, the DSO bills, we're starting briefings from the 11th. From the 11th of November. That will be it up until whenever we finish. We'll be meeting every day from that day up until whenever we are done. Depending on the days, the way we'll agree as a committee to say, no, on these days, let's not meet until. But from the 11th onwards, yeah. Another issue before we start with the defense bills. As I said, welcome to the department. Can I now hand over to the department to address us? Start with the apology, and if there are any other issues that you want to address us on before we engage the bill. Babunjigela, I wonder, Gazwena, maybe you must be leaving this delegation. If it's not you, I don't know who would that be. Bab.
Thank you very much. Perhaps I should begin by expressing the apology, as you already indicated, Chair, that Mr. Ladla, due to prior commitments, has not been able to join us and to lead this delegation as a representative of the NCACC. Now, I'm sure, Chair, you will appreciate that it does somehow impact on the kind of work that we need to do here, because from a policy side, as a representative of the NCACC, he's better positioned to deal with the policy aspects of this. Colonel Apsu and I are really from the drafting and technical point of view. But I think, Chair, we will do our best to deal with those issues that we can deal with. I've been informed that possibly Mr. Ladda may join us this afternoon, and therefore he will be present tomorrow, if the meeting spills over to tomorrow. Once he finishes his engagement today, he will take the first plane available to Cape Town. So hopefully we can be able to utilize him tomorrow to deal with those aspects that we could not sufficiently address today. Chair, I honestly do not know how you intend to deal with this. The last time we gave quite an extensive presentation on all the aspects of the bill. We will really request your guidance as to how you intend to utilize us today, but we are available to be used by the committee in whatever way we can assist, and we will do our best. So if we can just get an indication, Chair, how you intend us to proceed from here. Or should we go over the certain aspects of the bill? If there are specific areas that we need to revisit, we will be happy to do that. Thank you, Chair.
Siyabonga re leboga khensa go leboga yeah, if you remember, we after the briefing I allowed members to ask general questions. We haven't gone close by close yet. We haven't discussed this bill systematically, even to look into even the definitions, if we agree with them, if there are some definitions that have to be changed or we have to add some. So in fact, what I want us to do today was to go to the formal part. But I as I said earlier on, we accept the apology by Udada. Colleagues will advise me, I didn't want us to meet this afternoon. I wanted to avoid us meeting because, as I said, your chairperson is very flexible and very good and caring. We can't meet when there's medium-term budget this afternoon, because you must go and listen as to what the Minister of Finance is tabling before the National Assembly. That's how generous your chairperson is. But if you feel you don't need to hear Trevor Manuel, you have to meet. We can continue this afternoon and meet and deal with this bit close by close, continue again tomorrow and see if we are going to bring some amendments or not. Yeah, I don't know. Looking at exactly what you said, Bamundir, and because what I was going to do is for you to, for us to be systematic now, to say, no, can you address us from clause one and tell about these definitions and explain them. But before you do that, before we do, we go to that thus far. Let me check with my colleagues if you are still having general questions that you want to pose to the department. We deal with those so that we are done, then we go systematically now from clause one and see if there are discussions. Honorable Leroux.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm not sure of my facts at all, but I do recall reading some time ago that Danielle lost a very big contract as a result of the lack of urgency shown by the NCACC. Now, I would very much like to know, is there any truth in that? Do I remember correctly? And do you recall anything like that? Thank you, Chairperson.
Any other question?
Not a question. I want to apologize for Honorable Ntuli sitting in that committee of Mseneka.
The famous committee. Yeah, my friend, you want to respond to the question by Honorable Leroux?
Thank you very much once again, Chair. I think, Chair, the issue of the capacity of the NCACC has been a subject of a very long discussion. as to whether it has the sufficient capacity in terms of the administrative or secretarial support. And I think it is an issue that was also raised again by the National Assembly when we dealt with the bill. And I think in all the engagements we have had with the National Assembly, that there has been always an indication that there are capacity problems.
Sorry, but once again, colleagues, can we all stand there? Honorable Van der Merwe is here.
I'm sorry for the place.
No, Derek. Sit and relax and enjoy the meeting.
Thank you.
So long again, I can continue.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I was just indicating that in all the engagements we have had, I think there has been an acceptance that administratively there may be capacity problems within the Department of Defense. But that is an issue that being addressed internally. Which is one aspect of it. And I think even in the last meeting, Chair, that we had with this committee, Mr. Zanda tried to respond to some of the issues that have been reported in the media about the capacity of the NCAC, and I think he clearly indicated that. In as much as there may be those capacity problems, in his view, some of those views are exaggerated when they are expressed through the media. So I think it can only be proper, Chair, that if we need to deal with those issues, that perhaps the NCACC, together with its administrative capacity within the DOD, be specifically invited to deal what are the challenges that they have in terms of capacity. But I do not believe from both of us, Colonel Apsu and me, will be able to deal sufficiently with that issue. But I think it's the issue that is being attended to. But as to the extent of that process, I think the relevant people from the NCACC and from Mr. Zanda's office will be able to explain what is it that is being done currently internally to address the issues of capacity. But I believe there is a process to that effect. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, I think it's a fair comment. If needs be, we might, maybe before we finalize, we might invite the NCACC to come, you know, and deal with some of these questions. Because to check how effective are they, and one other question that was asked in the last meeting, I'm trying to refresh my mind, Babun Jigera and Colonel Amsi, if you'll still try to assist me here, because I asked a question about the domestic transfer. The domestic transfer, as you remember, at the transfer of ownership of the control item from one owner to the next, locally in the same country, in our country. The question I asked is, how are we going to monitor that kind of transaction is taking place? How are we going to monitor it? Because these items we are talking about here ranges from some smaller items to bigger items. So I'm trying to remember exactly how was the response, because I'm still not convinced that the department will be able to monitor that that movement of those controlled items from one owner to the next. I don't think we can, with brave face, to say yes, we can monitor them. Can you assist me, please? Allay my fears.
Thank you, Chair. Yes. As we mentioned, the regulations still have to be compiled once this legislation goes through. Now, as we mentioned last time, there's about 280 pages of controlled items, so one will have to define what items are going to be subject to, on the dual use goods list specifically, on the one hand, and on the military list on the other hand. Items will be looked at on both of those lists. And in the regulations, those ones will be specifically highlighted. This is how I understand it, which will merit control, specific control. So that will come out in the regulations, sir.
I hear you, Pastor. Let me hear Babunji.
I think, Chair, it is a very fair question. And again, I think the answer to that will unfortunately link with the issues of capacity. Because you will remember in our last appearance, we had indicated that there has been a concern from the NCACC point of view with regard to the bias of the Act itself. Now, if you read the Act as it stands, it creates an impression that the focus of the arms control is on export and imports. Now the question is, what do you do about an exchange between Njikela and HC within the borders of South Africa? Are we saying we don't want to regulate those kind of exchanges? And I think that's where the whole issue of domestic transfer came in. Because we said, in as much as we need to control the exchange outside the borders or inside coming into the country, but we need to deal with people who exchange these kind of weapons internally, there has to be sufficient mechanism. And in our view, in terms of the Act, actually we had a case with one of the mining companies with respect to this issue, where they were buying an APC. Now the question was, how do you regulate the transfer of APC within the borders of South Africa? Here is a mining company that wants to acquire an armored personnel carrier. Now the question is, what in the first place are you going to do with this thing? And the company will tell you, we'll use it when there is labor unrest, for instance. Or we use these APCs to transfer, maybe to transport gold or whatever, precious stone from one place to the other. But the question was, what is the basis for the NCACC to have visibility over those kind of transfers within the borders of South Africa? Now, when the matter was debated, was that there is a need to have that kind of control. If Njikela acquires an APC, the NCACC as the regulatory body should be aware who possesses what within South Africa and for what purpose. So, of course, Chair, like you are saying, it raises the issues of capacity once we have legislated for that kind of control. What measures do you have in place to ensure that you are able to monitor and evaluate to ensure that people comply with the law? So it is inevitable that once you have dealt with this issue, you will have to go and deal with the issue of the capacity of the NCACC. And I think even in the last appearance, we dealt with the issue of inspectorate, that within the Act as it stands, there is a directorate called the Inspectorate, which is supposed to be an arm for the NCACC to go and do investigation with regard to possession of all the control items. But of course, again, the capacity of that directorate has to be looked at as to what is the extent of the personnel on the ground. Will they be able to do that? But what you will see in that in the bill, we empower the directorate in the execution of its function to be able to call upon the police official to assist it in doing that work, up until all the issues of capacity have been dealt with. But to extend their capacity, we're giving them the power to be able to call upon the South African Police Service to support them in those kind of inspections, search and seizures, if there is that need. So that's why we're trying to deal with it in the interim. But I don't think it deals with the issue of capacity. We may give the police, but I think somebody will have to beef up the inspectorate, the capacity of the inspectorate to be able to do independently the kind of monitoring that is called upon by the issue of domestic transfer. Thank you very much.
Just one more issue. I may be losing my mind, but I can't really recall this funny thing called the Wassenaar list. If they can just tell me again exactly what it is, and does it deal with sensitive information if we sell arms to another country? And if you can just tell me again what exactly is the Wassenaar list.
But while they're noting it, you please respond to this one as well. Don't you think we have to have a time limit in terms of there is this clause here that says this provision here that says if Company A in South Africa sell these controlled items to country C, regardless of the years, if country C wants to sell that controlled item to country Z, still they must get permission from country A, that is South Africa. There's no time limit there. I was saying even after 20 years or whatever,
Even if that item is dilapidated, it's sold to charity organizations. Just for, I'm looking at, let's say, our CASPAs in our country that have been given to schools as a, you know, just as an educational whatever, I don't know how to call it. Still, you know, they had to get permission from South Africa. I thought maybe if we can have a time limit to say, of course I know some items can last forever, you know, they can be good for until whenever time. But I'm just speaking aloud. I don't have a concrete proposal now, but I just want to get your view as to what do you think about this one. So to get this indefinite arrangement to say, you remember the last time I quit to say, but if I bought the item from South Africa now, that's this my item. I paid for it, it's now mine. But still, if I want to sell or if I want to, let's say, disbundle, you know, that particular item, still I had to ask permission from the seller. It's a bit confusing, but maybe you'll educate some of us so that we understand exactly what I'm trying to achieve by this. Yeah, can you, any other question before they respond to these three questions? Babunji, can I answer?
Chair, I will deal with the last two questions. I'll allow Colonel Aitu to deal with the Vassanar list and see if he can be able to go into the technicalities of what exactly is, what is in there. But Chair, with regard to the issue of the EUC, and I think this is a very important principle, and I accept, Chair, it does look strange that you will buy a property then still be expected to come in. But we need to accept the reality that we're not dealing with your ordinary property. We're dealing with dangerous weapons for which each country in terms of international regime is held accountable. If I produce a Roy Falk, I have a responsibility to make sure that it does not end up with some rebels in whatever country. Maybe I shouldn't mention names. But there is that responsibility on all the state parties to this kind of international. So Chair, I think that's the principle we're trying to enforce here, that in terms of weapons, there is a responsibility on each country to make sure that even where equipment is being exported, there is some kind of regulatory mechanism to ensure that those kind of weapons do not end up in wrong hands. And I think that's the principle internationally. That's why EUCs are a norm in all the countries that have a developed defense industry, to make sure that there is that kind of control. Not only is that South Africa that requires, but South Africa, if we acquire a Gripen, we have the same obligations to make sure that we cannot sell it to another country, because it's not only the equipment itself, but there are issues of intellectual property that are attended to that. So the country needs to get some guarantees that once South Africa has had this thing, it's not going to use this thing in a manner that may undermine the market back home or its international market, so that those countries remain competitive as the owners of the original product. So again, this issue raises the same issues of how do you monitor that once you have sold a Roy Falk to Chad, how do you make sure that you follow your Roy Falk once it's there, you know that it has not been sold to Nigeria. Again, it goes back to the issue, but I don't think we can compromise on the principle based on the practical difficulties in monitoring those kind of issues. South Africa needs to be able, if it's called upon in the UN, to say, we have sold this kind of an equipment to a particular country. And in terms of what is required of us, in terms of international regimes, we obtain an EUC, an end-user certificate, which says this country will not re-export this particular item without our permission. If that country indeed has done that, then the UN can be able to deal, or any other structure, to deal and see who is not complying with the international requirement when it comes to trade in arms. So I think we cannot really run away from that. But perhaps there is merit in the question you are raising as to whether one will consider linking it to a particular period. But an intellectual property is something that can endure beyond 30 years. depending, because you can adapt to use it to other equipment. You will want to have control over your intellectual property wherever it is, so that it's not used in other manners that will undermine your own business or competitiveness as a country. But I think basically the principle is there has to be that accountability even beyond your borders. You need to be satisfied the other countries that you are taking all the necessary measures to ensure that your equipment is not spread throughout the world without your knowledge and consent. Thank you, Chair.
Before can I also deal with the Wassenaar, Doc?
Listen, I hear the explanation given here, and it does make sense. The EUC certificate and so on, intellectual property matters and things like that. And when it was discussed, the enforceability of such agreements immediately sprang to my mind, jumped to my mind. But there's always, but that must then be an exception. Suppose two countries, one who has a Rooivalk or a Gripen, is at war with another country, and such a Gripen, Rooivalk, is being shot down. What prevents the other country then to utilize all the equipment and to invest? That's a technical thing, I know. What can be done? Then, as far as I'm concerned, Chairperson, nothing can be done in such a situation. There goes my intellectual property and so on. I just want to get the comments from the gentleman.
Yeah, maybe before they respond, yeah, I said the tea is ready. You can quietly sneak out and grab your tea. Usually I know Vuyiswa, she used to give me rooibos tea, but today she didn't give me one. I wonder why. Maybe I'll have to stand up and go and grab my own tea. I don't know. Before you come in as well, Honorable Mac.
No, thank you, Chair. See, I also don't see sense in this thing, because the statement made of avoiding these weaponry, the landing into the wrong hands. Now, who defines wrong? If you go to United Nations, which is controlled by America, they will define who's wrong, according to them, as they are defining who uses nuclear power, whether the situation with Iran and Syria. Even if you get this nuclear capability for domestic use, they say it's wrong, you are trying to make a bomb. Same with Iraq, where there were only allegations. So, the whole thing, who identifies the wrong hands? Even so United Nations will define who is wrong. And I see it as a whole manipulation on this issue of weapons. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, the issue of capacity have been mentioned several times. Capacity of the NCAACC. In my mind, I'm asking myself, how do we define this? Is it lack of capacity in terms of numbers in the organogram of to deal with a massive work, or is it lack of capacity in appreciating and conceptualizing their role, or is it lack of capacity in terms of legislation and rules? They might be wanting to do some things in order to enhance their role, but perhaps legislation or regulation prevent them from doing so. We might then talk of lack of capacity in that regard. But how do we define these? Thanks, Chair.
Yeah. It's a million-dollar question. And in your response as well, Emma, try to respond as to how often do we check those items that those are sold? I want you to the expression used by Dr. Van Heerden, that there goes my intellectual property. How often do we use we check if they are still intact? We wait for that country to inform us that no, we are now selling it to country Z. It's only then we are checking. Because this thing is worries me, because you know, it's good to legislate, but to only legislate for the sake of it, while we know that this can be monitored, it's to me really, unless they were just playing to the gallery. But we have sold this ammunition to that country. How often does this count? Do we monitor if that particular control item is still there? You know, because I suspect, as was said by one of my colleagues, one country might decide to sell to their friends and just keep quiet. What then? Unless if someone will report to say, no man, we learned that your intellectual property has been now sold to, you know, to other countries. If there's no reporting, I mean, it could be life as usual, not unusual in our country. Any other question before they respond? I know these are a bit technical, but we have to understand before really we say yeah or nay to this thing. Babunji again.
I'm just wondering if I shouldn't give Colonel Ibsy to firstly deal with the Vassanar before we lose it, then we can deal with the other questions, okay?
Thank you, Chair. I gave quite a long salvo in the last session, so I'll try and keep it short in this session. As we mentioned then, the Vassanar arrangement, it's an arrangement where a group of 40 states came together, and it's mostly the responsible arms-producing states have come together as an independent form of a club. It's headquartered in Vienna, Austria. South Africa was the most recent country to join in about 2 years ago. Their main objective is to deliver every year an export control list. And this list is broken up into two major parts. There's a part for dual-use goods, which is, when we say dual-use goods, we're talking about goods and technologies. We're talking about the means of production and the actual items that are produced that could be used in a military role, but have a dual use in this commercial sector as well. For example, high-speed computers, lasers, all kinds of high technology items that are pushing on to the limits of technology in some cases, and in other cases items that are very simple materials like boron dust. Boron is used in nuclear reactors to moderate the nuclear reactors. It's used in all kinds of chemicals. I think you can even use it in the cooking industry for baking cakes. Certain boron compounds are used there as well. So you get this particular material is used in a wide variety, also used for cutting rock on the edge of cutting tools and cutting metals. Boron is used. So it's a strategic material that can be misused in certain places. So in some instances, when it's in a certain shape and form, it is regulated. And the idea of this Vassanar arrangement is to get a grip onto uncontrolled proliferation around the world of arms. On the military list, the other list is, of course, the munitions list, they call it, which is basically military items are tabled on that list. So we have these two major lists, and to define what items are identified on there are very complicated technical definitions. And on, for example, computers, the speed of computers is advancing all the time, so they have to try and lift the bar and keep the standard so that they can open it up to the commercial industry so that they can import and export and play computer games and that type of thing at that level. But at the same time, the high speed forefront of military capability, where that control limit is lifted in the high technology domains, and so that is basically where we sit with these two lists. On the dual use list, of course, there are some items that are very sensitive and the items that are in between, which I call sensitive. Now, these very sensitive items are the type of items that terrorists are looking for in order to create weapons of mass destruction or to use develop high technology capabilities, which they can use to produce weapons. So there are some of those components then that are elevated in their status on that control list in the dual use goods. As I say, on the military list, it ranges from guns through battleships to gun sights to camouflage nets to ships to all kinds of technologies, military technologies. And as I say, these people look through these lists on a regular basis every year, and at the end of the year they come out with an update on the list. And because this list is so voluminous, we're talking about nearly 300 pages of technical jargon and all kinds of items, different kinds of explosives, all sorts of things. It is a very handy list to just take as your baseline standard, so when you are going to look at export control and you have this pack of documents, it forms a standardized document, because there are 40 other countries or 39 other countries that are also adopting this standard, and possibly other countries around the world are also using it as a benchmark. Now, every country is free to adjust the list as they like, but if you go too far from the list, if you cross off a lot of items on those lists, you start endangering the credibility. If you say, I'm not going to control small arms and light weapons, or I'm not going to control tanks and battleships on my list, so you can import and export as you like, then you will come into a question with the other 39 states to say, why aren't you controlling this particular item? So basically, we try and stay as close to this list as possible, but we have the freedom to deviate from it, or to even make it stronger if we have that risk in our regional area. So that is basically the whole function of the list, just to define what are we talking about.
Before we move out to that one, Honorable Leroux, do you want to make a follow-up on this?
No, thank you very much. I understand it 100% now. So.
Yep, can you continue, Chief?
Chair, I'll try again and deal with the issue of the EUC, because it's becoming a hot issue now. Chair, I think perhaps as a point of departure, we need to accept that there is an international system of arms control. And South Africa is just one player in that system. And I think the system itself appreciates that. Arms control will never be successful unless there is international cooperation on the matter. Otherwise, we might as well all go home. If countries cannot cooperate on the issue of arms control, the system will never work. And I think the whole requirement with regard to EUC is informed by that. The test is, what would a responsible trader in arms require of the customer? Now, according to the international system, what you will require is that there should be some kind of guarantee that the weapons will go to countries and countries that are considered to be responsible. Then I will come to the question of wrong hands or responsible countries. Now, Chair, I just want to emphasize the issue of the international system. So internationally, there is an agreement. Each and every responsible trader should be able to get those guarantees from the other countries with which you trade. Otherwise, the system will collapse. And that's where the EUC comes from. To say, you sell to Njikela, you must make sure that Njikela, in the same way under the Firearms Control Act, you need to make sure that Njikela is competent to possess a firearm. So you need to look into the systems that Njikela has, or the competence that Njikela has, to possess a firearm. That's what a responsible trader will. So the same principle applies to the issue of the UUC. I can only trade with you in respect of these arms if you can guarantee that. Once I have given you a Royfalk, that there is a guarantee that you will not re-export this Royfalk without my permission as the selling country, because I own the Royfalk and I have a responsibility in terms of the UN requirements to make sure that these arms do not end up in wrong hands. But now, Chairperson, the question is, what is the wrong hands? Now, I think there are two ways one can really try to define that. For instance, in terms of the UN system, there will be...
Yeah, maybe let me allow you to pause, because as you said, this is very sensitive, very technical and very demanding. I wanted to pause and enjoy your tea. Can you organize tea for Mujigela so that I can see he's getting into the gist of what...
Thank you.
Yeah. Honourable members, you can see I've been joined by our calculated, dynamic, wonderful, excellent Minister of Justice. In his very tight schedule, he said he feels he wanted to come and see us and say, just to come and say, here I am now as part of this team. So we appreciate to have people like him who in their very tight schedule want to come and say, no, here I am now as the new minister in this cluster. Here I am. Well, Minister, welcome. Thank you very much for taking time to come and greet us. And we appreciate your efforts. We know that your table is full, but as you promised, you said, no, I will make time to come and greet the committee so that I be welcomed and start to introduce myself. Thank you very much, Minister. I flagged the discussion about the defense bill. I want to allow the minister to address the committee, just to greet us. What you can assure you, Honourable Minister, we are going to cooperate with you and we are going to work with you. You know, you started so nicely by just coming to us. Let me tell you, colleagues, I didn't force him to come here, but he volunteered. Said, no, I want to. I think it's ethical for me to, before I start doing whatever, so that I come and say to the committee, here I am. I mean, how many can do that? You know, it's only a minister and Vasuti, you know. And Minister, we're all yes. Immediately after you've addressed us, I won't allow people to ask you questions, because this is just to come and say, I'm here, please welcome me into this cluster. Honourable Minister, over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson. It's really a great pleasure to be here, and I thought I'd utilize this as an opportunity just to say hello to the members of the SELAC committee. Certainly the National Council of Provinces has been my previous home, and I see members who are here with whom I'd worked for a long time, including the Chairperson. He was under my political command at one stage when I was Chief Whip. But to say to the committee that I recognize that what is different between this SELAC committee and the Portfolio Committee of Justice, for example, is that you deal with issues that go beyond justice. You deal with defense, you deal with intelligence, you deal with correctional services. So the enormous commitment from this SELAC committee is really appreciated. And the fact of the matter that I do know from past experience that this is an extremely busy and engaging committee. And to really wish you well and to thank you for the application, for your hard work and dedication in ensuring that the legislation that we've introduced will indeed be finalized with the appropriate amendments. Already in my short stay or stint within the ministry, I've discovered that certain amendments had been suggested by the National Council of Provinces with regard to some legislation. I considered the amendments and in fact said, well, I'm quite happy with them. So it certainly means that the voice, even if it's a Section 75 bill of the National Council of Provinces, is taken very, very seriously, Chairperson. So to the members of your committee, to give you the assurance that I will listen attentively to your recommendations and your suggestions, and be available to support you wherever possible. So really, this is just to say hello. I do, at least there were three of us that spent almost a week together in the Judicial Services Commission last week. It got us an opportunity, well, it provided me with the opportunity to engage with the Chairperson as well as Rick out there, and I think it was useful. And perhaps just to say, without going to the details of the JSC, it was an unusually interesting week where we were as a collective able to converge and make recommendations which we do believe deal with both the issues of having people who are competent, fit and proper to serve in the judiciary, as well as to deal with the issues of transformation in a way that's dignified, responsible and would serve the best interests of our country. I think that augurs well for the future, and it is this kind of mood that I really want to create in terms of my relationship with Parliament, with the Portfolio Committee, as well as the Select Committee. So really, I'm saying to you, I will, as I have been in the past, be committed to the committees of this House and the House, which is a very important House, and given my past experiences and my home, I'm not surprised that people still call me Chief Whip and not Deputy Minister or Minister. But that is part of my presence. And thank you very much for your very able leadership out here. I know you have a busy schedule, so I'm not going to spend much more time other than saying thank you for this opportunity. If there are any burning questions, I'm more than happy to deal with them. But I'm in your good hands. So I'm really, in a sense, as your loyal subject, visiting your committee. He's both my chief and the chairperson of the committee, you know, and I told him I'm one of his subjects from those days. So he says he's in command, but I'm available to you. And certainly, I know the tendency in the past has been to pay particular attention to the activities of the one house and less attention to the activities of the other house, not realizing the parity and the contributions that come from both sides. So I'm mindful of that, and that's why I say you will always have my ear, and I would be available to you. It might well mean that we have to work at night on occasions, but certainly that is possible and can be arranged. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Harold Minister. as you said, he'll be ready to take whatever general questions, but don't ask him about stats and whatever, please, not today. If the just general question that they think you want to ask the minister, as you said, they will be ready to take whatever question. But that will be only for a given short period. Honorable Leru?
Not a question at all, just a comment, Minister. Thank you very much for coming to us. You are a very nice man. We can all see that. You have a nice open door policy, and it augurs well for the future. Thank you, sir.
Honorable Fanere.
Chairperson, yes. Just to confirm what the Minister indicated here, that I, at that JSC meeting, utilized the opportunity just to bring something under his attention, and it will have already the meeting with its connection with the administration of justice in the lower courts in particular, and I will avail him with he's quite a willing ear, Chairperson, and we really appreciate that, and we wish him well. Thank you.
I will request the Honorable Mkhalipi to speak on behalf of the ruling party at the end. Yes. Maybe just to say to the minister, we just reported this morning that this class that together with our colleagues in the NA from the 24th of November to the 5th of December will be going to provinces just to hear their views about the this review of the criminal justice system. So I know the minister will be supporting us in whatever, so that we deliver the final product to our communities, having had the support of the department. Thanks for the nice comment, Honorable Leru and Honorable Van Herde. Before the minister maybe talk to whatever, Honorable Mkhalipi.
Thanks, Chair. Indeed, it's rare in some circumstances, other circumstances, to have a public rep, a member of the executive, coming to you as an oversight authority, say, here am I, keep me on my toes. But to us in the ANC, the ruling party, this is common cause. But then we are very happy we are living up to that. Honorable Minister, we've had some of us some time last week, just a little baptism of fire with some written questions, but then we hope we'll take things from there. Honorable Minister, we'll have a very, very exciting time, and on our time can only be exciting if each of us play their role, because that's all what we are about here. We are happy, Honourable Minister, you've just confirmed it. We wish you well.
Yeah, thanks very much, colleagues, for those kind words. Can I now hand over to the Chief Whip, or Honorable Minister?
Well, you see, here's the evidence. But thank you very, very much for your kind words and your sentiments. It certainly isn't an easy job. It's going to be very demanding, given the many things that are occurring at the same time. But with the support I think I've had enormous support from all quarters, and that's been very, very helpful to do things with conviction. And I will continue to persist or do it the way I've always done it, be consistent, predictable in terms of what I do, and be level-headed and open-minded about issues. I want to share with you perhaps and say this is my gift to you, but it involves some work. I haven't shared it with anybody, not with the media, not even with my staff. We have coming upon us the 16 days of activism, and I had thought and reflected about this matter here, and I thought what would be very, very useful for the Department of Justice, and I certainly would be able, I believe, to be able to persuade the presidency as well as the coordinator of the 16 Days of Activism program to have our program hang under a particular theme. You remember the previous themes were Speak Up or Break the Silence. This year's theme I'm going to suggest, and certainly it would be a theme from the Department of Justice, would be Our Home, Our Fortress for Safety and Peace. Now, that allows us to basically look at the issues of abuse within the homes, domestic violence, and draw into the system or administration of justice the fundamental importance of the home, the family, and society at large, so that justice itself is not seen as an activity of parliament or government, but it's something that we should all commit ourselves to. So the campaign from the perspective of the Ministry and Department of Justice would be really Our Home as a fortress for security and peace. That means, well, how do you speak to your child? What kind of values you engender and infuse in the child? How do you respect and regard your spouse? Is there abuse over there? And how do you protect your home in a way that you produce and develop the kind of and mature the kind of citizen that could contribute to the peace and security of our country. So, as you and I raise this with you in the context of the fact that you would be going to all 9 provinces, and perhaps if you could, and I will write to you formally, Chairperson, about the final product, because I have to consult with my department in terms of what I think would be an appropriate theme for us to carry through for this year and the next 365 days. And I would certainly encourage you to just raise that and create some kind of public awareness. I would also then invite the entire committee, not only the chair, but the entire committee from all political parties, to be able to engage with community radio stations along those themes, so that becomes a responsibility. Our peace, our safety and security becomes a responsibility not of one political party or one individual, but of the collective at large. So I don't know if you have any views about this matter here, whether you happy, maybe use you as a sounding board to say, before I take it to any, I haven't taken to the portfolio committee or anywhere else. This is like groundbreaking news over here. So you have the benefit of it. But if you have a view that is contrary to the view that I hold, please feel free to tell me, look, you know, I think you should look at something else. And if you do, please, I invite you to make any suggestions, because I would like to finalize this by the end of this week so that I could formalize it and then make an announcement accordingly. Thank you.
Wow, how nice. Oh, wonderful. Thanks very much, General Minister. I think we'll communicate to your office. I think I can, without any doubt, without convincing my colleague that it sounds a dynamic and very good and progressive proposal, the theme you're coming up with. Thanks very much, General Minister. We'll formally really convey this to your office. That's our response to it. But I can see I don't see us coming with any other thing other than what was just proposed. I just hope even in future good things can start from the NCOP, you know.
You try.
Yeah, maybe let me also reveal this secret before. You'll see, no, maybe next year some other people will be leading some of these committees. When the person who was chairing this committee, it was Mushin Musa. When he retired from politics, and by then yours truly was serving in the Agriculture and Public Services Committee, it was the Honorable Minister who was the Chief Whip then who proposed my name to the ANC-NEC. And surprisingly, they agreed with him that yours truly must come and chair this committee. That was then. I haven't told this to anyone. I'm revealing this thing because you also revealed some of the secrets. So that's this kind of minister for you. Thanks, Honorable Minister. And I hope up until then, I hope I haven't disappointed you.
And it's only two terms.
Yeah, I think what then, colleagues, let's thank the minister. Really, we are proud to have this kind of ministers. Really, thanks very much, Honorable Minister, for respecting us as this committee. As rightly said, you know, if it were our wish, we're going to suggest that all Section 76 legislation should start in the NCOP. That is going to make life easy. But as you know, we'll talk about this as we go. Section 76 legislation, it would make sense if they start from the NCOP, you know.
Well, I can tell you all education legislation that was Section 76 started in the NCOP.
Where?
Something that I've carried out
good.
In practice.
Good. Good. Thanks very much. If you want to sit, relax, enjoy our meeting,
I think you'll all understand. Last week has been a challenging week, but this week has been even more challenging.
Thanks very much, Minister. Yeah, that's true.
Thanks
very much. Yeah, that was a nice commercial break. Can we continue? Babu Njikela, I abruptly and unceremoniously stopped you while you were really drilling the point home. Can I allow you to continue?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I was just trying to deal with the issue as to what will be the undesirable hands. It was just the peddling a little bit. Chair, I was saying that this can be done in one of two ways. I think the simplest way is in those countries where, for instance, there is a UN embargo, where internationally there is that agreement that a particular embargo should be imposed against a country. That's a clear-cut example, and I think it's the simplest way to do that, because internationally there will be that consensus. I don't want Chair to go into those details about consensus, but here is an international body that makes particular findings with respect to a particular country or a particular group of people. So it's very easy. All countries that are member states to the UN will be bound by that resolution, and they will have to comply to make sure that certain kinds of weapons don't land in those hands. But I think the second way of doing it, Chair, is what we already have in Section 15 of the NCAC Act, which sets out the guiding principles and criteria for trade in arms. And it lists a number of issues, Chair. But among those, it simply states that each application should be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. But among the issues that the NCAC has to consider before it enters into those is to look at the issue of national security interest of the Republic, avoid contributing to internal repression, including the systematic violation or suppression of human rights and fundamental freedom. avoid transfer of conventional arms to government that systematically violate or suppress human rights. Avoid transfers to areas where it's likely to contribute to the escalation of regional military instability. So those are the issues that are already built in terms of the criteria of the Act, that the NCAC must make those considerations. But again, I will agree with Honorable Mac that those are political value judgments that the executive has to make as to whether a particular country will contribute to the violation of human rights or not. But there is already criteria that is built into the Act, which the MCACC, before it issues permit, must apply in practice to say, will these arms be used to oppress people? Will these arms be used to create instability and all those kinds of things? So those are the two simplest ways to deal with that. Of course, we all know the dynamics of international organizations, that the powerful countries may have bigger influence than the rest. But there is already that criteria that is built in into the system. But unfortunately, as a public servant, I can't comment further than what I'm saying to you. That the system is already built in there. Chair, if I may just proceed again to the issue of, I think it was Honorable Mkalipi who raised the issue of capacity. What is it? What are we talking about when we talk of capacity of the NCAC? And I think the simplest way to answer the question actually is a combination of all the issues that you mentioned. There is an issue of capacity administratively. That is, the people, when a person comes into the department and says, I want a particular permit, how long does it take to process that permit up to the end, to the time when you get a permit? Administratively, there are people who must process that up until the point when it reaches the NCACC. And if you look at the proposal that we are making, again, it goes to the issue of regulatory capacity. Does the Act as it stands empower the NCACC to foster the kind of regulation that is desirable in terms of South Africa's international obligations and the security interests of the country on its own? So that's why we are proposing particular amendments, because we feel that there could be an improvement. And one example was the issue that Chairperson had raised, the issue of domestic transfer. Because in our view, the Act is biased towards export and import, and it doesn't say anything about what happens within the borders of the country. So we think regulatory, there is a loophole that needs to be filled, hence the proposal for this thing. But I think that there is another issue, Chair, that I think it was Honorable Leroux who raised it, the issue of the regularity of the meetings of the NCACC, as to whether the NCACC meets as it is required to meet to be able to deal with the permits. So I think it's all those combinations of three issues to say, in terms of feet on the ground, in terms of regulatory mechanism, in terms of the ability of the ANC to meet, NCAC to meet when it is required to meet and attend to the permits. So I think it is a combination of those. But like I indicated, institutionally there is already an attempt to beef the capacity of the NCAC in terms of administrative staff to ensure that when permits come in, they are processed quickly for the NCA to take a decision whenever it sees. So it is that combination, Chair. Thanks.
I hope you noted the concerns I raised. How often do you check, or if country A sold their equipment to country B, you wait until something happened. You don't regularly check as to whether that particular item is still there. You know, I'm looking at the friendship that is there between, I'm just giving a rough examples, don't ever touch anything. You look at the friendship that is there between America and Israel, for example. Let's look at that. Now, if you sold an item, you said you sold an item to America, and they want to give it to Israel. I'm looking at the scenario as to, really, will you be able to monitor that? US, Babunjie. I remember there was this attack on or invasion on Iraq. I'm just giving you a rough example. I'm not attaching anything. There was this UN cry in our account to say there were those equipment that we sold to America, and those equipment were used in Iraq. You remember? And there was a big question to say, but how come the South Africa sold those items to America? And those items are now being used in the invasion in Iraq. That's what I'm saying to say, but I get your point to say it's a mammoth task to monitor those equipment that we sold to other countries. Welcome, Madam Rena. I know you, with your experience, will get very quickly. We are the same bill, arms control, controlled items that were sold to other companies, Samara. But yeah, that's where we are. So the department are busy trying to give us some howl so that we understand this even further. Yeah, that's where I was. I wanted to respond to that, Teba.
I do believe that we will not be honest if we say it's easy to monitor. I think everybody accepts it, even not only South Africa, that to actually monitor what happens in another country is a difficult issue, because there are issues of jurisdiction which you will not ordinarily have to just go and say, I want to see what is in your warehouses and all that. So those are practicalities that are really all the nations are facing. But I think the point is, Chair, that's why all the state parties are required to do annual reports to the UN as to with regard to all the exchanges of arms. But again, it may be difficult for South Africa to know exactly what is disclosed, for instance, by country A is the true reflection of what they have exchanged with the other one. But that's why initially I indicated that there has to be this reliance on both the parties. If we are saying we are all parties to the Wassenaar list, for instance, we need to accept that when Niger says he is doing this, he is doing that. Because as South Africa or as an individual country, you will not be in a position to go and inspect that is playing the, according to the rules of that. But that's why we have international agreements to make sure that all parties commit themselves to a framework which they will live by. So there is reliance on the goodwill of each country to those kind of arrangements. And the difficulty is really monitoring, because you can't just go into a particular country. But we are hoping that through the reporting processes, which all countries are subject to, we will be able to pick up what countries are doing what. And I don't think, Chair, we can really do more than that, more especially when it comes to foreign jurisdiction in terms of inspections and all those things. Thank you, Chair.
I don't see. Any other question? Get into Cuba is fine.
Yes, you see, this is my whole story, the determination on who's wrong and who's right. If you look at the influence on Cuba, the embargo against Cuba, I mean, it's totally, for me, it's totally wrong. And United Nations have voted how many times in favor, no, of lifting this embargo. But the determination by some powerful nation still keeps this in place. And
it's a rogue nation.
Yeah, it is determined as a rogue nation. I've been to Cuba, and it's been, I mean, I haven't experienced any rogueness there. So that my issue is the determination of who is a wrong nation. Tomorrow, the decision might be South Africa is a wrong nation. On what is that determination based? And I mean, sometimes it's wrongfully instituted, the whole embargo thing. But as I accept, these are political decisions, and I accept that explanation. But it still is with me. Thank you.
No, it will be clarified. It has to be clarified as we move along. You are raising a very good question, Honorable Mecca. To say who determines a wrong country.
Yeah.
Some people, Cuba is a wrong country, but to some other the countries, it's not a good country. Some people, Israel is a wrong country, but to some, it's not a wrong country. Now, there were some arms that they went to our shores, they were on their way to Zimbabwe. To some people, those arms went to a nice country, but to some, Zimbabwe is not a good country. Hey, this is a very difficult one. It's a difficult one. Honorable Lero?
Chairperson, obviously we're moving on very thin ice if we start saying things like my friend said now about Cuba, because I have family working in Cuba, and there's no freedom in Cuba. You're not even allowed to own a boat in Cuba because they're so scared you're going to row over to America. And there's no liberty in Cuba. So these are different views, and I don't think this committee is the place to express those views. We have a different
set of things that we must achieve in this committee. And I don't think that is one of them.
Now, maybe to put things into context, Honorable Leroux, as we had, we're just giving examples. How I look at Swaziland, for example, I can't expect other members or other parties to look at Swaziland the way I do. Because to me, I'll say Swaziland, there's no democracy there. Because they're still ruled by Tinkundla. That has been identified by the king and some other stuff. That's what I'm going to say. There's no democracy there. But people might say, no, it's nice because the people are the king will identify people and people will be expected to go and vote for those people. You know? But not parties. I mean, it's fine, the nice democracy where people are expressing their views based on what the king wants. I mean, who can blame them for that? But as far as I'm concerned, there's no democracy there. That's why I will agree with you to say this committee cannot, we can't determine a good and a bad country. We're just giving examples as to say who determines a good country when South Africa will sell a control item to a particular country. And if that particular country will decide to sell that those items to another country, I think that's a discussion where it is. Mm. We're not dwelling on which countries are good and bad. No. We're just giving examples in terms of monitoring. The question I raised to say, if I bought this material, it's mine now. It's mine. I own it. But in terms of this arrangement, even the UN, the convention, even if country B bought these kind of materials, you must know that you bought that material, but it's not yours completely. Someone had to monitor how to use it. Where do you sell it to? You know, who are your friends? But I'm glad with the department's response to say this is a very difficult area to get deliver on. It needs all of us, the department and even public reps and all of us. How can we get it right? As I said, I don't have an answer for it. But this collective, I think, at some point, before we pass this bill, we'll. Doc?
Chairperson, I think that we are a member of that 40 nations in Vienna, and I think we must stick to that, whether you like Zimbabwe and I like Israel or whatever the case may be. Maybe, I think, it's beyond this committee's function, Chairperson. I think the way we are going in now, we must come back another day to discuss things like that. I would suggest that we carry on item by item now, because we are talking a lot of things on the periphery, Chairperson, which is very interesting, and we can engage there for a long time. But I think, in all fairness to the department, they would like to dispose. They are not part of our discussions. It's actually a political thing, and in honesty to them, and I think in all fairness to them, I think let's start working on this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and. Thank you for calming down everything nicely. As I indicated early on, so we have a very urgent caucus, and I would like you please to excuse myself and my colleague for now. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, you gave notice earlier on. But Derek, you owe this committee a lot, because you must come and make up for the long time, you know?
I have made up twice.
Okay.
I'll send an SOS what we
now. Well, you'll regret it. You'll regret it, I'm telling you. Yeah. Let me allow colleagues, if you are having other questions. It was a very interesting discussion here. You know, it's a very interesting discussion. And other questions were still. All general questions, colleagues. If there are no questions, you want to address us on clause one, or before that, Honorable Mkhali, please.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, Chair, also that you have some kind of patience with a newcomer. I'll ask the department just to elaborate more on this, what he described as, or as a phrase, freedom or exemption to deviate. I didn't get it clear. When does it apply?
You get that? I assume in as far as it relates to the EUCs,
yes.
The exemption. Chair, in our last appearance, Mr. Lada tried to explain this. What we seek to achieve through the bill is to give the NCACC a discretion in certain circumstances to waive the requirement of an EUC. In other words, even though we are selling an equipment, in certain circumstances, the NCACC, of course on good cause shown, may decide not to insist on the EUC. And what we have in mind here, Chair, is where, for instance, we are selling components that will then be integrated into a bigger system. Take for instance, let's just stick with the example of a Gripen. A Gripen is as big as this room, but there may be a pistol or something, an equipment of this size, which a particular company may be in Sweden that may buy from South Africa. Now the question is, in terms of the EUC, the Gripen cannot be sold without the permission of South Africa because of the component part which is fitted or integrated into the bigger system. Now obviously that EU, I mean that Gripen cannot go anywhere as long as there is a South African component in that EUC. In other words, if Sweden now wants to sell the Gripen to America, it must come back to South Africa and say, we bought this component part from South Africa, which was integrated into a Gripen. We're now selling the Gripen to the US, to the USA. Can you permit us to transfer this thing with your component part? Those are the kind of situations we're trying to have in mind, where is a small component that is being integrated into a bigger system? The MCAC may exercise its discretion and decide to exempt those countries from having to come back to South Africa for a small part. So that's what we basically have in mind, Chair, that they can exercise that discretion in that respect. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Mzizi.
Thank you, Chairperson, and also my apology. I had to go to a final mandate in another bills in another committee. Chairperson, I think the crux of the matter lies with the honesty of a country which has bought a weapon from a country. Now, to me, I still also find it difficult. If I have bought something, who else would tell me what to do with that? I've paid you, it's out of you. But this is not a question probably that we need to raise. We have a bill before us which we have to pass. Now, these probably silly questions that are being asked. It's not that they are asked because we want to test the knowledge of the presenter, but is to empower ourselves. I think what we want to know, though we know that we cannot be told everything that is in the secret document, what it would be entailed in an agreement when a country buys that weapon? Is there any binding agreement that you would not sell this without coming back to us? And what would be the response of the country then, of that a country that buys that item, to say, am I still have the anything to do with the country to go and ask permission if I want to dispose of this item? Now, if we could probably get that, what has been put into place to embody that, the country will know that this item I bought from South Africa or anywhere else, I cannot sell it without going back to a country where I've bought this thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You need to feel like I've earned my salary today. Honorable Mzizi, the end user certificate is what South African agency, that is in this case the NCACC, will require from any other country. If we sell our equipment to the U.S. We require the U.S. to certify that they are buying this thing, they will use it for their own purposes, but they cannot re-export it to any other country. That is the certificate they have to issue to the NCACC. It's a guarantee, in other words, between government and government, to say, we want your equipment. We guarantee you that we are not going to sell it to any other country without your permission. They can use it. I was tempted to respond when the chairperson raised the issue of Iran, because I remember reading the story, which is a very interesting situation, where they are saying there are South African equipment in the U.S. which is being used in Iraq. Now, you see, these are the issues that always come up, because these things are evolutionary in nature. You try to expand your regulatory framework, but as you go, you begin to pick new things. Because, you see, the United States is involved in a war in Iraq and is using some of the weapons that were bought from South Africa. Now, that is not a permanent transfer. The U.S. was not transferring the weapons to Iraq or was not selling the weapons to Iraq, but America was using them as part of its defense force in Iraq. So these are the other kinds of dynamics. You see, that you pick as you go. How do you deal with that situation? It is a very interesting development, but I don't have an answer. But I'm just saying, if the U.S. was selling to Iraq, we would have said, in terms of your EUC, you cannot do that without our permission. But that was not the same to the other country. But they were being used by the Americans, but in another country for the purposes of a war. So it was a very interesting development. As I was reading the newspaper, I wonder how would you deal with this thing practically? Because it's a new development that one would really have to apply his mind. How would you like to tell the other country where they should use those weapons or how they can use those weapons? Or do you want a guarantee that they will not sell them to any other country, which may not fit your criteria in terms of your Section 15? But Chair, that was just a thought on that matter. Thank you.
Yeah. It's becoming more and more this thing. Honorable Mac?
Yeah, Chair, it's not only Iraq. There was a huge furor, you know, when the Argentinians sank the English battleship with an Exocet missile that was loaded in Simonstown. I don't know if you remember back in the Falklands War. There was an Exocet missile that the English used and sank the Argentinian ship. And that was also from South Africa. But my other question is, we bought equipment and we have a submarine which they say is out of order, it's in Simonstown. Skills were also transferred to South Africans to maintain that ship. Now, if we manufacture, I'm now coming to a type of copywriting, if we manufacture our own submarine and we use that technology, are we allowed to do it for our own purpose? Because as we go on servicing and maintaining Gripens, we will develop the skill to develop, to manufacture our own Gripen. As in the old regime, when there was an arms embargo against South Africa, they manufactured their own stuff and then copyright in this wasn't involved. So does this also include that? Are we not permitted now? After 10 years, we don't want to buy from Sweden anymore. We can do our own thing. And we can, and then the technology, as you said, the big word, the intellectual technology that we have now taken over, we are then using it to manufacture our own. So we'll be allowed to do that. Thank you, Chief.
While noting that question, for you to respond, are you in for it? Now, can UN, can the Security Council through UN, can they take action against country A if country A knowingly sold this weapon to country B, knowing that the country B might end up using that weapon to attack a country that we are sympathetic to? I wonder if I'm clear. Yeah. While opponent is going to make this question. I wanted to look to this one as well. I'm now looking at the situation of the question that when we're trying to respond to the South Africa, US, Iraq scenario.
Chair, the issue of intellectual property is normally governed by a separate agreement, like the example of the Gripen. Well, I assume the Swedes will enter into an agreement with South Africa as to how that IP could be used by South Africa. They will normally put a prohibition on use for commercial purposes. Generally, that is normally the prohibition they will place on you because they own the IP. They may say for a particular period of years, you may not do it because they already have a market and they want to interact with those various markets in the world. So there may be a clause to that effect in the bilateral agreement, but not necessarily under the auspices of the Act itself. But between the countries, there may be a prohibition to say you cannot use this IP in certain ways that may undermine our competitive edge in the world. They may just put a clause to that effect because they still have to sell it to other countries, not only to South Africa. But if South Africa is going to begin to compete with them directly, it may affect their business interests. So there may be, normally they will put those kind of limitations either in terms of period or the kind of use that they will do. Chair, I'm not sure if I understood your question correctly. Can the UN take action against a country that sells weapons to a country we will not approve? Is that the essence of it?
No. The question is, can UN take an action against us if we as South Africa, knowingly, you know, we sold these weapons to US, knowing very well that US is going to use those weapons to attack a country we are sympathetic to, or a country that it's our friend?
Chair, I think perhaps foreign affairs should be here to some of the issues. Chair, I can only think of a situation where there is a particular arms embargo. Maybe some action could be taken against a country that sells those weapons fully knowing that they are destined for a particular country. I think the UN may want to have a discussion with South Africa in those instances. But I don't think where there is no embargo, that country will be in trouble. But I think where there is a specific embargo and you deliberately sell to that country knowing that they are destined for the particular country that is under UN embargo, you may have to explain yourself. But like I said, Chair, it's not really our area of defense. And I don't want to make statements that foreign affairs may not really agree with. Thank you.
Yes, Doc. Chairperson, yes, I fully agree with the last statement. You know, we are now going far beyond this Act, Chairperson. And I think that, as I read the Act, I think that this Act was drafted to accompany or to provide for the provisions for that 40 nations, Chairperson. And we are engaging in really very interesting discussions which can last very long, Chairperson. And there are international and foreign agreements which will cater for the questions that we ask now, which is very interesting. But I really think that as I have it in, now this Act was drafted according to fit in with the requirements of that 40 arms producing states, and I think we can leave all the other discussions, though it's very, very interesting and very, very, very important as well, but I don't think that's part of the Act. It is international foreign relations and agreements and so on. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, well tried, Doc. Now, it's part of this thing because we are dealing with a controlled item that might leave our country to go to another country. Those items that are going to be used to attack other countries or whatever. That's where I am. That's where my mogul is. But maybe I agree with you. Let's move on and flag this one. We'll come back to it because I want to understand that when we pass this legislation, as rightly said, in terms of monitoring, we're not passing something out there. We're not, you know, just for passing legislation for the sake of it. like what we did in legislation and the sexual offenses. You remember, we took much of our time dealing with sexual offenses. It's an act now. Where some of the provisions were just defied, you know, defied openly. And nothing is done, you know, because we just, you know, passed it because we were caucused by another entity, you know. So that's where I am. But we'll talk about it at some point. I think I agree with you. Maybe on our own, without a department, we can ruffle and tumble and see if we...
Just one example. For instance, today, country A is in a friendly relationship with country B. Something might happen, and you sell back weapons to country B with a provision you can't sell it to country C because we are also, you know, friends and pals. And then something happens in between. Chairperson, it's a complicated thing, and I don't think we can legislate for complicated things. I think we must legislate generally and get on with it and leave the other stuff when we get to the foreign and international world, Chairperson. But I agree with you, it's something for another discussion.
I fully agree with you, Doc. It's exactly what I'm trying to remove here. Me and you are speaking the same language now.
Yeah.
I'm glad now we are on board. Thank you very much. No, but we'll talk about it at some point. Can I check if there are other questions? We're left with an hour now. But I thought we'll break at our first 12. I don't know, most will tell us where are we having our lunch. Because after working so hard, I think Babu Njigera deserves some nice, sumptuous lunch somewhere. But let me check if there are other questions. Let's talk about these definitions, Babu Njigera. These are the definitions here. Now, this export and re-exporting and whatever, can you tell me under what conditions can that happen? Import and what is it? I saw another. On page 4 of the bill, re-exporting. Under what conditions can that happen? It's after we've imported an item and decided to sell it back. If we sell it back, is it to the same country or another country? Or if we are re-exporting, for the purpose that item had to be used for charity organizations, are the same conditions apply under those circumstances? If that country be that is receiving the items now, if that item will now be used for charity organizations or some other things, as I said in the beginning, are the same conditions apply where the permit, end user certificate, and all those stuff still apply?
Yes, Chair, in terms of the conditions, they apply across the board, irrespective of who is the recipient. But there must be those guarantees given to South Africa that the weapons will be dealt with in a certain way. But I think re-exporting refers exactly to that issue where we export an equipment to country A, and country A wants to move it from there to another country or sells it to another country. So that's where you want those guarantees, that will not be done without consultation with the original country, because they will be further re-exporting it again. Although you export it to them, but they want to take it somewhere else. So you need those guarantees in those instances that this will be done in consultation with the original country on the same conditions, unless, of course, the NCAC may exercise its discretion in respect of exemptions. You remember I spoke of exemptions, that the NCA in certain instances may decide to grant exemptions with regard to those guarantees. But the conditions will apply across the board except where there are those exemptions.
The exemption will be under what conditions? Can you give examples of under which exemptions? What will allow that country to be exempted? Under which conditions? Let me say that is damaged, dilapidated, is no more dangerous, or is under which conditions?
Well, Chair, I just gave you an example where we're selling a component which will be integrated, for instance, in a bigger system. That would be one example that comes to mind immediately. A small component that will be integrated into a bigger system. The NCAC may say you don't have to come to South Africa for that particular component because it is part of a bigger one.
If they want to remove that small component but they want to sell the bigger component, that is no more dangerous. Will the same conditions apply? Yeah, but they want to sell the whole bigger chunk, but the only country B wants to retain that small item, but the bigger chunk had to be resold somewhere, to be re-exported. And it's no more dangerous because we have removed that particular minor item. Are the same conditions apply?
You see, Chair, we will only be interested in that equipment in as far as it contains South African component. If they take away the South African component, and they are therefore not re-exporting the South African component, that is really not the issue for South Africa, because that will be their system they developed in their own country. But our interest is that there are components that are South African, which are of a conventional nature in terms of the vaccinalism. But once it's not part of that system, they can export it in terms of their own laws. But if it has that component, then our jurisdiction comes in, they have to speak to South Africa. But without that, we have no jurisdiction over that because there is no South African component in that particular instance.
Let's assume this South African component is still there. They only remove this minor item of the bigger machine that comes from South Africa. They want to re-export it somewhere else. But they've removed this part that makes it to be so dangerous. They've removed it and they still keep it. But they want to sell the shell that is of no danger. And if it's send anywhere of abuse. Can the same conditions still apply?
Chef, from a regulatory point of view, it's either a particular item or equipment is a conventional arm or not. Whether you take this thing out, what we use the Wassenaar list, which tells us what is a conventional arm. If you decide to remove a trigger and you are saying it cannot fire without the trigger, so it's no longer a conventional arm, well, we'll have difficulty because Wassenaar defines a system as a whole, not with a trigger. A gun is a gun. Even if you take out the trigger and put it in your pocket, it will be a gun. Otherwise, everybody will take a trigger and say it's not a gun now because my trigger is in my pocket, so I can't use it. So we look at the system as a whole, not the components that form the equipment itself. A gun without a trigger, without a bullet, will be a gun. So it's a controlled item in terms of that.
You know, I'm asking this. I remember we're at Free State. You know, we swayed the time to convince Dr. Van Heerden, but he stuck to his guns in terms of the Firearms Control Act. You know, whether people want to use those weapons just for at their houses, just there's no more cartridge, there's nothing, just where the people can be exempted to own those firearms, even though, you know. So now, in terms of this legislation, we don't have those kind of flexibility. As long as it is this ammunition, even if you remove everything, it just becomes a cell, this shell. The same conditions will apply. That's what you're saying.
You see, Jay, it comes back to the issue of the introduction of possession of a conventional arm. So in our view, we wouldn't want to go and speak and start looking at the individual component parts. If it fits the definition of the Wassenaar list, that is a conventional arm. I'm thinking of an example. That take an APC. I just want to put it in my lawn and decorate with it. So somebody may say, well, it's just for decorative purposes, so I'm not using it as a weapon or anything. But does it mean it must exist outside the framework of the legislation? Or we need to be able to say, do you have a permit for decorating with this kind of a weapon? I think I remember the debate around people keeping arms for purposes of sentimental value and all those things. But from our perspective, we want to look at the system. Does Jigela have a permit to keep an APC? Even if he never drives it for whatever purpose, but he's just keeping it in his lawn. So the question is, shouldn't you have a permit to do that? Because it may end up in the wrong hands, even though you're just putting it there. There must be mechanism for the NCAC to have visibility who possesses what and for what purpose. and a permit should be issued accordingly. I don't know. I have an expert next.
It takes us back to the regulations. We'll have to go through an exercise once we have the mandate, if the legislation is passed, to say conventional arms, look at the munitions list and say, if people are keeping tanks in their backyards or in monuments or in these shell holes where the veterans get together and they have a tank parked outside, we will have to sit and say, define what items on that list we need special control. One of the items will very likely be armored personnel carriers, APCs, and certain other kinds of armored vehicles, perhaps guns, but perhaps somebody keeping a battleship in his backyard, a small one maybe or something. You'll have to decide if that's going to go on the list, that you're going to have to control it, or we are not going to control those items. And we have to look at dual-use goods as well. There might be, on the whole, no dual-use goods will be controlled for the possession thereof, but maybe one or two items, maybe those items that are on the very sensitive list, you might have to have a possession certificate for that. That exercise will have to be determined in the future when we get to assessing the regulations and what has to go in them as regards possession.
No. Yes, just a question, and I think what the answer can be, or will be, an empty shell. I don't think that can be included. I'll tell you why I asked this question, Chairperson. I was involved in appearing for people who purchase abalone. You know, according to the Act, even in that particular court, there were certain ashtrays, just the empty shell of the abalone. And according to the definition in the Environmental Act, that was an offence. And it was mentioned to the prosecutor, and during the tea break, all the empty shells simply just disappeared. Just to make sure that we do not come with this ridiculous thing like that.
Do you want to comment on that?
I think it is a very relevant discussion, Chair, because you will define a conventional AM in terms of its capabilities. I don't know if you understand the point I'm making. You will define a conventional AM in terms of what it can do. The only reason you regulate is because of the dangers it poses to you and me. Now, I don't want to preempt the exercise of us determining, because in terms of there will be a list that will be published based on the Vassanar list. But I think what makes it necessary for each government to regulate this kind of equipment is because of the harm they pose. So I think that would be a criteria, but of course that discussion will have to take place when people begin to look at the Vassanar, what is it that has to be regulated. But I think it would be dangerous for one to, in a very roundabout way, saying a shell will not be regulated at this stage. Because you see, that again has to do with the capability. So I think on a case-by-case basis, a judgment has to be made. But you can't just take out a trigger, for instance, from a gun and say it's no longer a gun. Because you can assemble that within a matter of minutes, and it becomes a gun again. So I think on a case-by-case basis, we need to go into that exercise as to what is it that you will exclude. But I think that should be linked to the capability of that, at the regulations level, yes.
Thank you, Chair. I think if we all look on page 13 of the bill, paragraph, the amendment to section 27, it sets out the categories of list of controlled items which will be regulated. I think what's relevant to the discussions we just had now, Chair, is any component, equipment, system, processes and technology of whatever nature capable of being used in design, development, manufacture, upgrading, refurbishment of maintenance of anything contemplated in paragraph A. And paragraph A sets out a whole list of weapons, explosives, bombs, etc. So I think from a regulatory perspective, that will be catered for the concerns which has been raised now. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Good. Can we continue? Is there any other question that colleagues want to ask on definitions? I want us to clean these definitions and check if we'll come back to what you just said in terms of the clause you just referred us to. I've got an issue to raise there, but let me leave it go for now. I don't think there are questions here. I wanted to check. I know what the permit is versus the certificate. But this question asked last week, which one has got more weight between a permit and a certificate? Which one comes first? So permit is, I don't think it's a good way than a certificate. Only that question was asked last week. Can I check?
Chair, I don't recall it being asked. But like you indicating, it's two different things. If I want to sell to country A, I need a permit to take that equipment to that country. But now the second leg of that, you must have the certificate from that country in terms of the guarantees we require. So your first step is a permit. Actually, as a trader in conventional arms, you will firstly need to be registered as part of a registered company that deals with those. For you to export, you will need to get an export permit. Then once that, you will also need to get, then the NCAC will require the EUC from that country that it will not re-export without a permission. So they are part of a continuum. Registration, permit, then the EUC. So they are part of the same value chain.
Who must be certificated? The country that sells or the country that receives?
The individual who sells must be registered and have permit to export. The country must provide South Africa with an EUC. It's been a long day.
No, yeah, I think let's bear with him. Let's bear with him. Let's bear with him. I understand. No, we really pushed you very hard. Can I ask?
To simplify, a certificate is a promise, and a permit is a permission.
No. Menier, come on. No. Talk to this thing. Who must be certificated? Because I know a permit, it's if I want to remove this thing, I must get permit before I sell this thing to country B. The question is, who must be certificated? Is it the country that receives, or is the country that sells? Who must be certificated?
Chair, I would say that the recipient has to certify that he's going to abide by a certain code of conduct or the terms of reference that are in that certificate. So effectively, he promises not to misbehave, or he promises to comply with the conditions that are on that certificate. And the, as far as the exporter is concerned, he gets permission from the government to go ahead and export to the person who is certified that when he gets the stuff, he's going to comply with the terms that are on that certificate. It's like, in that sense, I see a certificate as an undertaking that where you promise to comply with the conditions on that certificate. And the exporter is then given a permission to go ahead and export when the government is satisfied that those things are all in place, then a permission is given, or a permit, permitting the exporter to export. Obviously, the government that receives the goods on the other side, the receiving country, its government will require an import permit. So whether one country gives an export permit, the recipient country will give its own internal establishment an import permit to the end user in that country that's importing it. But that's their administration. From our side, it's just the export administration that comes into play.
Okay, I'm saying, no, unless if I'm a slow thinker. Maybe we'll flag it and come back to it, because I am saying, who must be certificated? You are saying the one that sells this thing to country B will get a permit, right? A permit to say, I'm selling this thing, I'm exporting this thing to country B. Now, I thought you would say country B must be certificated, must give assurance to say, yes, when this item gets into my terrain, I'm not going to use it for any other thing, but for the purpose it's earmarked for. That's the certificate we're talking about. I thought that's where we're getting to. But what you're saying now about the other one also getting a permit, because the question that might follow from that is that now let's deal with re-exporting. It means now both countries must be certificated. Are you agree with me, can I answer?
I'm not quite sure I understand that in that sense. What we are seeing is two governments, maybe even three governments working in a, or the businesses in three governments working in a consortium, where they are building a common product, for example, a submarine, and South Africa undertakes to build a periscope for the submarine, and for example, America will build the engine for the submarine, and Germany will build the hull, and perhaps France will build the weapons. And all these countries are working together to build these various components, and it becomes a weapon system that they are going to produce, and maybe the weapon system is housed, for example, in Germany, and they're all working together, and it is covered by a kind of an agreement where they're all going to work together to build this product, sharing the best of the technologies in the various countries. But because we might be building 500 parts that go into that equipment, we can't overload our administration with 500 end-user certificates for every single part that goes into that one boat. What we really need is just one, just to approve the contract, because if all the governments are happy that we are going to produce this submarine jointly as a consortium, then we don't really need to worry about end-user certificates, because the holding country, for example, Germany, who's going to export these submarines around the world, we leave our trust in Germany to export to responsibly, and we know that Germany, for example, has got a responsible export control system. We also know that they're a member of Wassenaar, for example, which improves their status as a reliable country. So therefore, we are, as a government, are satisfied that Germany will, as the main exporter of this product, will do it responsibly. So therefore, we can do away with every part we make. We have to have an end-user certificate, and every part we need an export permit for that particular part. So what we do then is we give them a bulk authority to the manufacturer here in South Africa and say, on that submarine contract, you can go ahead, just keep a list of all the parts you give to Germany to put into that family of submarines they are building. And now and again we'll do a check on that country to see that system is using 20 torpedo guidance systems and we are making 20. If we're making 30 and they're only being used for 20, then we know there's a discrepancy in this. So why are you making an extra 10? But we have the capability inside the South African arms control environment where there's an inspectorate that does check these numbers. So the onus is on the country, on the company that's making it, to do it with a bulk authority. And we will verify it from time to time on the tally that they keep. That's how we see it. Thank you. I hope I've answered the question.
No, I think it's high time that I think we're too.
let's flag the discussion. Let's stop the discussion. Yeah, we'll continue tomorrow, because we'll continue tomorrow anyway. But if you want us to meet after the speech by Trevor Manuel, or just meet tomorrow. Just meet tomorrow. Right. Where is our this thing? Can those in charge tell those people to bring our lunch now? Now it's out.